Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Kreisel and Diane Duvernay are your hosts every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 11, and on Saturdays at 3. We're brought to you by Broadview Mortgage, whose highly trained and experienced team takes great pride in helping people with home financing, offering competitive rates and a wide array of loan programs. And CIO Solutions, providing superior IT services to companies and nonprofit organizations in the Tri-County area. They're experts at managing and maintaining IT networks with the resources to solve any problem. And Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1940, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara. And Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm, coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
Hi, Neil. How are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Enjoying the summer weather we have here in Santa Barbara.
And waiting for the traffic to start in a couple of days.
Traffic? What do you mean?
Aren't we having Fiesta?
Oh, that's a good point, Fiesta. Yeah. Downtown. Yeah, right by my office, actually.
Yeah, so we won't be lonely this week.
No, we will not. Okay. It's funny, Neil and I were talking before the show, and we were talking about that guy who jumped 25,000 feet without a parachute this weekend.
Yeah.
Crazy. He made it, though, which was great.
Richard,
you should YouTube the video.
Richard, our engineer, was thinking of doing that. But he decided not to. And luckily, because we're on the air now, and so it would have been probably problematic if you actually had done that jump. So, as we always do, we begin with some interesting, or we think are interesting, articles that appeared in the newspapers or on the news. And the first one is about the dividend boost that tech stocks seem to have universally been showing, and as a result, I use the word liberally, the legacy tech stocks, that is, stocks that were very big in the 90s, whether it be IBM or Cisco, have increased their dividends over the last few years. And because yields are so low, in general, because interest rates are so low, these stocks have outperformed the averages because you get the benefit of a stock and a relatively high yield. But the problem with this, and this is what the article is focusing on, is that what fuels growth is reinvestment. And always, from a theoretical point of view, a company should not pay dividends if their return on equity is greater than the investor's return. And the reverse is true. A company should return equity to its investors if their opportunity cost is less than the investor. And so if you look at what's happening is people are investing heavily in stocks that pay a high dividend, when the irony is they're able to pay a high dividend because they don't have the growth prospects they once had. And the companies that do have growth prospects, whether it be Facebook or Google, or otherwise known as Alphabet, pay no dividend and haven't been as attractive as these dividend-paying stocks recently. And so the article basically sums up by saying, you know, at the end of the day, if there's no growth, then these companies may prove, despite their dividend, to be overpriced.
That said, but I think in today's interest rate environment that we're in, it's important to note that people are really looking for interest rates or some return in the way of cash flow from their investments. And dividend-paying stocks is one way that you can do that.
Well, yeah, and that's true, and I think that's why they're doing it. But I think that, you know, companies should be more focused on what is best for their
bottom line. That's what they should be most concerned with, as opposed to
their stock. And I think that part of the motivation, I'm not saying this is true for IBM or Cisco, but sometimes companies will increase its dividend or its buybacks, which are essentially returning money to investors in different forms, but that's effectively the same thing, which will just boost the price of the stock short term. But over the long term, it reduces the potential growth. And I think that's a short term benefit that really over the long term will prove to be problematical. So the next article is entitled Why Your 401k Is Not Safe at Home, and home being the company you work for. Many people, in fact, a substantial number of people who work for companies that have 401k plans, take the lazy way out, which is to say they keep their investment money in the company they work for. And the problem with that is that they're exposed to a problem in the company that is what who employs them, which is where their paycheck comes from. If they were to lose their job because the company were to falter, they would also lose their stock investment as well.
I see that all too often in my practice where I meet with people and most of their 401k money is invested in the company in which they work. I normally recommend to diversify. It's far too risky. And it's funny because a lot of people don't realize the risk because they feel like they know it because they work there. But most rank and file employees and even upper management employees don't fully understand what's going on in the balance sheet. I look to an example of when I was working at Merrill Lynch. Many people invested in Merrill Lynch company stock. It did very well. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that even the CEOs of that company didn't fully understand the balance sheet of what was going on with Merrill Lynch and consequently went out of business.
Well, and again, this is one of the reasons why people really do need a financial advisor. A survey, this is the article goes on to say, a survey of 1,500 people found that 51% believe that a diversified bundle of 10 investments is more volatile than a portfolio consisting of a single stock.
It's so shocking.
It's really shocking.
And sad, because a lot of people lose a lot of money using, you know, investing in their company's stock when they wouldn't need to if they diversified it and had more of a balanced portfolio.
And this article had a plethora of very interesting factoids. At the end, it says that the Wilshire 5000 stock index in 2013 gained 34%, but only five stocks, Amazon, Alphabet, Microsoft, and Facebook, and General Electric, accounted for over 100% of that return. So think about it. If you are your own advisor, are you going to pick the five stocks out of 5,000 that are going to be 100% of the gain? And so, you know, whether it's this lack of understanding of diversification or the arrogance of thinking you can pick those five stocks, people really need to, I think, have professional help.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Neil.
Yes, and you are the professional help. My professional help at my age is a therapist.
And your wife provides that
right,
service
for you?
My
wife's a therapist. You're right. But I think she's given up on me anyway, therapy-wise.
This seems like this could be a topic of a whole nother show.
Could I lie down? I feel more comfortable.
If only there were a couch.
Right. Investors do the hard rather than the easy thing. And this article talks about the chasing of yield and willingness to invest in anything that has a high yield, because people are not satisfied with the very, very low yields and therefore will ignore risk in order to get a few extra basis points in their return, given the very, very low rates that we have today. And the article is interesting because it looks at the psychology behind this. And it says, for example, a study showed that poor children drastically overestimate the size of coins compared to prosperous children. So when asked how big a dime, a quarter, or half a dollar was, poor children overestimated the value of the size by 30%. And it's about deprivation. When people feel deprived, and when people in this case feel that they're not getting enough yield, they will fool themselves into thinking that even though in ordinary times they would think that investing in a particular asset class just for the yield could be very risky and irresponsible, they will fool themselves into believing that it's a good thing to do.
It's true. It's funny. When you talk about deprivation, I often say when people are trying to figure out how much money they're spending in a given month, that I say, well, why don't you just write down everything that you spend, or if you use credit cards as your method of payment, look back at what you're spending. But don't not buy that cup of coffee if you buy a cup of coffee every day at Starbucks, or don't not do it. A lot like, you know, the nutritionist will say when she's trying to help you either lose weight or eat more healthy, don't, if every day you eat a piece of chocolate, but because you're keeping a food journal, you don't eat that piece of chocolate. What we're trying to do is figure out what that number is. So don't deprive yourself.
And exactly. And this article actually goes with another article that's in the front page of today's Money and Investing section in the Wall Street Journal. And I point out that it's in today's paper because I don't think anyone's going to believe what I'm about to say. And that is, the title is Hunt for Returns Reaches to Pakistan. Now, this is an unbelievable article. This is talking about a $49 billion money management firm that has recently started to invest in the Pakistan stock market because he is looking for yield. Now, I'm not saying I know a lot about everything, although sometimes...
You don't say that?
Actually, I do say that. But in this case, I may be missing something, but I don't think so, that he and another firm has been investing in...
Sri Lanka.
In Sri Lanka. I think that there has to be some degree of a sanity check here. Whatever the prospects are for Pakistan and a company in Pakistan to do well has to be offset by the instability of that region. And when people say, I can get a couple of hundred basis points investing in Pakistan, I think it's time to head for the hills.
Well, I often say if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Mm-hmm. And you want to really reevaluate that risk that you're taking because you want to understand what you're investing in and what risk you are taking to get that type of return. And so I often advise people to make sure they know what they're investing in. If they hear something that sounds too good to be true, chances are it probably is.
Richard, does our signal go to Pakistan? It does, so that's too bad because I just...
Because now they're going to come after you, Neil.
I take it all back. Pakistan is my favorite place to invest. You're listening to Money Talk right here on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Broadview Mortgage. Since 1988, a mortgage banker and direct lender that believes in providing in-depth loan consulting to its customers in a personalized and honest manner. We can be reached at 564-1290 if you have any questions, or on email, moneytalk1290@gmail.com.
Please call in. We'd love to get some questions. And today we have in studio with us today Courtney DeSoto, who is the owner of Channel Island Fiduciary. And she is here to talk to us about what that actually means and tell us a little bit about herself. So, Courtney, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, hello, both of you. Neil, Diane, nice to see you. Thanks for having me. I'm a fiduciary, and a lot of people don't know what that is. Fiduciary is someone that is appointed by the court or chosen by a family member or the client themselves to assist them in managing their affairs when they generally can't do it anymore due to dementia or some sort of lack of capacity. And there's not an appropriate family member nearby, or maybe they don't have family at all, never married, no children. And so I serve that role as far as the agent for the power of attorney. I can be the trustee in the trust, the conservator for an incapacitated person.
So you handle all of those issues. So now how did you get to where you to be a fiduciary? I can't imagine that you graduated from college as a Westmont graduate, a local school. And how did you become Channel Island Fiduciary?
Well, I didn't know what a fiduciary was either. I had been working in social service for the Santa Barbara County Probation Department for about 10 years. And one of the assignments was the civil assignment. And in that assignment, we investigated the conservators, people like me, or family members that filled that role, to ensure that they were in compliance with the law and taking proper care of the conservatee. And so in that role, I not only learned about fiduciaries and what they do, but I was impressed by what they did. I enjoyed working with this particular clientele. And I ended up staying with the assignment long enough that when the laws changed in 2008, they moved my position directly over to the Superior Court. So I followed it and continued working in this capacity. Enjoyed it so much, I had an opportunity to leave and start my own business while maintaining the same work circle, just in a different role. And so I jumped on it.
So when you said that you were with the DA's office?
Probation.
Probation office. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what brought you to that probation office? You were in law school.
Well, I did go to law school while I was a probation officer, but I became interested in criminal law when I was at Westmont, a younger person, much younger than I am now.
Oh, no. Neil takes all the old jokes on this show.
Thank you for sharing.
just wanted to let her know. No need for her to self-deprecate.
Oh, I'm good at that, too, though. But yeah, so I became interested in criminal law specifically, and that's what prompted me to go to law school. I thought I wanted to work in the DA's office. And in doing so and learning about this area of the law, I think I found a niche that's much more suitable to me.
Interesting. So the probation department. So how did the probation department fit in with this fiduciary taking care of elderly financial affairs and persons?
Well, in California, the probate code requires that each county have a court investigator. And normally that court investigator works directly for the court. In two counties at the time I was doing this, Santa Barbara and one in Northern California, it was an officer from the probation department. Because we are attached to the court, the eyes and ears of the court, it made sense for someone like us to do that. But when the laws changed, it became too much of a demand on that one officer's time. It would have required an additional staff. And it was more appropriate for it to be supervised by the court. So that's when they decided to move it back and take it over.
Diane, we have our call.
Oh, interesting. We have a caller. Wonderful.
Nancy.
Hi, welcome to Money Talk.
Hi, my name is Nancy, and I have a question for Courtney.
Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Courtney. This is my question. I've heard the word fiduciary before because our parents, I have a sister who lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and our last parent passed away in March.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And I'm the executor of the estate, and we are arguing about property and money, and I don't want to have that kind of relationship with my sister. And somebody had mentioned that the possibility of working with a fiduciary. And could you explain to me how you could help us?
This is a perfect example of a fiduciary and how we can be helpful. In family conflict and contentious family situations, it's often better to have a neutral or a third party do the administrative work that you're in charge of now. In doing so, it often takes the stress and the conflict and any appearance of impropriety away from your brothers and sisters. No one's worried about getting information or being concerned that their sibling is taking advantage, perhaps, or not following the law. And it often creates family conflict. So that's one of the beauties, I think, of having a professional fiduciary. Anyone can serve in the role of a fiduciary. It's just a word that means a position of trust. So anyone can be an executor or a trustee. What's great, I think, about my profession and what we do is not only do we do this for a living, so we have a lot of experience, we have a lot of resources, we're familiar with the procedures, but we're also licensed. In order to be a professional fiduciary in the state of California, you have to be licensed by the Fiduciary Bureau. We have insurance. We're bondable on cases. We have to report to the court just like anyone else would in the same situation. So I know it sounds a little self-serving, Nancy, but perhaps in this situation, it would be ideal for someone like me, a neutral, to step in and kind of take over the reins. Oftentimes, fiduciaries, if they don't serve in the actual capacity, they can work for the family member that holds that capacity. So there's a trustee and someone doesn't want to relinquish their authority over their parents' estate, they can hire a fiduciary like me and we can consult and still assist in getting the work done.
Well, thank you, Courtney. I look forward to being in touch with you. Thank you.
Thank you for calling, Nancy.
Thanks, Nancy.
By the way, that's why you're the fiduciary and I'm not. If someone had called me and said, I'm having trouble getting along with my sister, I simply would have said, don't talk to your sister.
But well, that causes more problems, Neil.
Right. So that probably wouldn't have worked.
Neil, that's so Neil, though. So in other words, how would a lot of people in California have living trusts? And they have a successor trustee named. So when they can no longer serve as the trustee on their affairs,
correct,
they have a successor trustee. Now, if there's a successor trustee that then takes over while these people are still living, mm-hmm. could they hire somebody like yourself, a fiduciary, to help with bill paying and
sure.
that type of service?
Absolutely. We get a lot of our referrals from attorneys when they have clients coming into their offices setting up estate plans, and they're looking to name people in their documents. And they have children that they want to name first, perhaps. But they want to have a backup to make sure in case that person doesn't have the capacity or wherewithal or desire to handle the case to assist them. So that's, they could call. We could help do the consulting work and help them get through the process. They can also, depending on the language or terms of the trust, they can appoint somebody else to be their own successor.
Do you get paid as a percentage of assets or based on time?
I get paid based on time for the majority of my cases. There are some estate and probate administrative cases where we're paid a percentage of the value of the estate. But generally, I bill my time like an attorney does in six-minute increments.
And so the cases that you do get billed by percentage of assets, is that more court-mandated?
Yes.
So those are the court-mandated ones. Now, would you take the place of a probate attorney?
No. So fiduciaries are not attorneys, but we work very closely with them.
Interesting. Okay.
So you just play one on the radio, but you're
not. Well, I have a little bit of a legal background, so I know a little bit, and that helps in this capacity for sure. But no, we definitely need our attorneys as well.
You're listening to Money Talk on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by CIO Solutions, that has the expertise and resources to manage their clients' technical needs so they can focus on their business. You can reach us if you have any questions at 564-1290.
Yes, that was a great question by Nancy. So on the break, we were talking with Courtney DeSoto, who's in the studio. She's the owner of Channel Islands Fiduciary Group. And we were talking on the break about explain to us the difference between, say, a trustee, which most people are much more familiar with, at least in Santa Barbara, where a lot of people have living trusts, and a fiduciary.
Well, they're essentially the same thing. The fiduciary is just an umbrella term that encompasses various roles, one of which is the trustee. One is a conservator. One is the agent on the power of attorney, executor in an estate or administrator of an estate. We are put in place as the decision makers to help essentially, especially post-death probate administration, marshal the assets, pay the debts, and distribute the estate according to the terms of the estate planning document, if there is one, or hopefully according to the will of the person. But essentially, there's no difference.
And how long does an estate usually take to get closed up? I know it's case by case, but in general, is there a general...
Well, ideally, if it has to go through the probate process, it's a 9-month to 12-month process, which is why a lot of people in the legal field encourage trust, because trust, that device, avoids the probate process. If someone dies intestate without any sort of estate plan, that's when their estate needs to be probated, or if there's a will, or if they have a handwritten or holographic will, but they never did anything further, that's when you would step in, get appointed by the court, or seek the court's assistance in getting the estate managed and processed.
So I've got to imagine that it's easier on the family and for you if they actually have their estate planning or their estate plan in place, which is just a fancy term for having your
Absolutely.
Will and your guardianship if you have young kids and
Absolutely.
Your trust if necessary.
I encourage everyone to do that. And even since becoming a fiduciary and working in this field, I encourage family members, friends. It doesn't matter if you're young of age, young of heart. If you have children and assets, it's always best to put in writing what you want to have happen with them. It will only help the person like me who steps in at that time. We want to make sure that we honor your wishes, and there's no better way to do that than having something in writing to guide you.
And what kind of exposure do you have? If you're... fiduciary, and there's two, like take the telephone call where there was a sister and there was an argument. Are you subject to lawsuits from the quote-unquote other side? Do you have any indemnification?
The out sister, we'll call her?
Yeah, the out sister. I mean, if you're court appointed, I guess you're sort of immune, but you're not immune under any circumstances.
No, not at all. In fact, that's, I think, what has kept some people from properly understanding exactly what we do and maybe additional people from stepping into the role. We carry a lot of responsibility. We carry all the responsibility. If we are named and we are the acting fiduciary in one of these types of cases I mentioned, we're the decision makers, essentially the quarterback on the team. You know, I make sure their taxes are done and their doctor's appointments are made and their prescriptions are refilled. And I'm not always necessarily doing those small tasks myself. I have my staff that assists me, but that's or the caregivers that are in place. We hire caregivers. We determine if someone is living in an appropriate level of care, if they need to be moved. So we carry a lot of exposure for suits down the road, and we have to answer to the beneficiaries.
But beyond the usual, anyone in a service business has that exposure. But I'm thinking, if you go into a situation in which there's already animosity in a family feud, which is probably the worst kind of feud, isn't it almost likely that there's going to be some form of controversy and maybe litigation? Aren't you going into a battle even before the first shot's fired?
Well, sometimes it sounds a little daunting when you say it like that, Neil, but essentially you're right. And I think that is most characteristic of conservatorships.
Explain to us what that is.
Okay, so a conservatorship is when someone is appointed by the judge to manage somebody else's affairs while they're still living. They don't have the capacity to make their own decisions anymore. There's a lengthy court process that they must go through, and the judge has to make sure this is an appropriate course of action. But essentially, once we're stepped in, the decisions are on us. We have to make sure that we don't make any mistakes. And if we do, we have errors and omissions insurance to help protect us. But yes, we're absolutely stepping into a situation. We have our own attorneys that will work with us and defend us and make sure that the decisions we're making are appropriate, proper, and in the best interest of the conservatee.
So explain to us what the different types of conservatorships are.
There's a couple different types. There is the general probate conservatorship. That's generally for an elderly person with limited capacity. There is what's called an LPS conservatorship, and that stands for the Lanterman Petras Short Act. They're the last names of the gentleman that drew up the legislation. But that conservatorship is for those with mental illness. That must be initiated by the county mental health department. And then there's also what's called a limited conservatorship, and that is aimed specifically at someone with a developmental disability. And then Tri-County's Regional Center also gets involved and does an assessment as well.
So a conservatorship isn't something that maybe like our caller, Nancy, would come in and say, I need a conservatorship.
If her mother was incapacitated and still alive and she and her sister were fighting, it might be a good choice. It's also a last resort, at least it should be, because of how restrictive it is. It really restricts that particular person's liberties, their ability to vote, their ability to drive, certainly their ability to make their own decisions about their care and their finances.
So what happens if the person is alive and somebody is seeking a conservatorship for some person for some reason, for mental diminished capacity? What happens if the person doesn't agree?
They have several rights, the person that's in that position, the proposed conservatee. One of those rights is they have the right to independent counsel. So one of the things I would do is when someone was initiating a new conservatorship, when I was the court investigator, let me step back. When I was the court investigator and someone was initiating a new case, I would go out, I would meet with the proposed conservatee, kind of make my own evaluation based on my experience and training. And if I felt there was an issue, that would be the time I would present my concerns in writing to the judge. I inform the proposed conservatee what their rights are, one of which is they can attend the hearing. They have the right to a trial, and they have the right to have independent counsel. So if that's the case, I would always recommend that. They need to show up at the court hearing, and usually if they speak directly to the judge and they are of capacity, it's very clear. The judge will ask appropriate questions, and she has a very good understanding and grasp of the community and the law, of course, and she makes her decisions based on the information brought to her.
What happens with a situation like the caller had, where there is a clear incapacity on the mother's side, the client's side?
Well, the mother was dead in that call.
Whatever,
pretend call.
where people petitioning you is not the quote unquote person with funds. It's the two siblings are fighting.
Uh-huh.
So imagine two siblings fighting. It's like a divorce.
Mm.
What if sibling A picks you and sibling B picks somebody else? So in a sense, if there's, how do you agree on the one fiduciary, and is it expected that they will agree or you won't take the case?
Probably more the latter. There's only a small handful of fiduciaries here in town. We all know each other and work very well with each other. So in that case where, let's say, one sibling is recommending me and the other sibling is recommending another fiduciary, we would come together and have some sort of agreement. there certainly isn't a need to fight over it. And if we could come to court with a resolution, that's always
preferred. So you'd work
together.
So you'd have two.
No, I don't think we would need to. I think we'd just figure out who was the more appropriate person or who would work better in that particular situation. And ultimately, it's up to the judge.
So well, so if the judge appoints one of the two of you, that stops the angry sister from complaining later on?
Well, she can certainly keep complaining, but at least then there's a clear position or person in position of authority that can start taking the action and the steps that are needed.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara.
Unfortunately, my last bocce game did not go well, Neil.
Well, speaking of bocce, which is one of the attractions of Arnaldi's Cafe, we had the owner of Arnaldi's Cafe as a guest last week, and he pointed out, like I just repeated, that unlike our prior show saying that it was founded in 1940, it was actually founded in 1937.
I saw you pick up on that. Yeah, we had that wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Were you at the opening?
No, I'm far too young for that.
Oh, okay.
But the better question would be, Neil, were you? Anyway, we are in a studio today with Courtney DeSoto, who's the owner of Channel Island Fiduciary, and she is here to tell us about what fiduciaries mean and who needs them. And on the break, we were talking about a case study of a case that actually Courtney handles, and how, you know, Neil's very concerned about being in some sort of lawsuit, and so he was asking, well, how does it work, Courtney, if, you know, I have my sister and my sister doesn't like you and I want to use you. How does it all go down? So maybe you could share with us on air how a situation of disgruntled children handle a case such as, let's say, a disabled dad who you have two siblings that are just at odds. And, you know, I see it all too often in my practice is when people are at odds, it really doesn't matter about what. It could be about an old bed sheet that's stained. It could be about money.
It could be about the birthday gift for their 16th birthday.
Exactly. Yes. And so it really doesn't matter. So how do you handle something like that?
Well, you asked a couple questions. So I want to start back with, you said when Neil was mentioning if there's different siblings coming forward recommending different fiduciaries. That isn't always the case. Usually it's a sibling stepping forward asking that they be put in charge. And it's the other sibling that ends up objecting and saying, I don't want it to be you. I want it to be so-and-so instead. If it ever is two fiduciaries, then generally the court will decide if the two of us can't agree with the other parties who would work better in that particular situation.
Now, do you say something like, oh, if there are two fiduciaries, you and Susie Joe, and do you just say, well, Susie, why don't you take it and see what happens?
If someone's already working on the case and there's no reason to make a change, it's always best to keep things the way they are, if at all possible. Sometimes family personalities and conflicts come up. I had a case similar to what you were explaining, an elderly man, and he had two daughters that were fighting over him. And it almost became like a divorce as opposed to these children monitoring their parent. They kind of had taken a reverse flip in the roles, and one daughter wouldn't let the other daughter see him, and then they would argue about the transportation to the visit and where the visit could take place and what their elderly parent could eat during this visit. So it becomes very cumbersome, and you can see how if you didn't have a neutral third party and only siblings involved, you can see how this could just ramp things up in the family. So oftentimes if it's a family member coming forward and then someone else suggests a fiduciary and it's contentious at all, it almost always will go to the neutral objective third party. It's just a lot easier and generally more efficient.
Now, how does it get escalated to the court? You know, so I'm fighting with my sister. How does it, do one of the fighting parties need to suggest a fiduciary and move that way? How does it ever escalate?
Find us?
Right.
Well, generally they will find their attorneys or an attorney. Either got served with some conservatorship paperwork that they don't understand, or are seeking that control of their elderly parent, and so they seek out an attorney. And that's generally where they hear from us, and the attorney will suggest a fiduciary. A lot of people don't even know that we exist or that we do this for a living. And so, like I said, sometimes they don't know they need us until they actually need us.
So now in that scenario where there are two siblings, could one of them become the conservator?
Theoretically and legally,
without
yes.
the other one
sure.
agreeing?
Well, they'd have to go to court just like we would in any other case where we're appointed. The court has to agree. The court would have to appoint that person to be someone's conservator.
Okay.
So it oftentimes is a family member, and sometimes it's appropriate that it's a family member. But when there are those times when there's either no family nearby or no family at all, or the family's fighting, the court's very unlikely to pick somebody other than a neutral, objective third party, someone that they have seen and they're well aware of, they're aware of their work ethic. We all appear in front of our probate judges on a regular basis, so they know who we are.
So now, you had mentioned before the break that people, when they're creating their estate planning documents, at times will write in a fiduciary, such mm-hmm. as yourself, into the document. Now, would they write you into their estate planning documents as the successor trustee of their trust, or?
Sure. It can be any number of things. I've had people write me in as their advanced health care directive, only because they were never married and they have no children, and their closest friend lives in, Boston. So there really isn't anyone to make those decisions. So this particular client I'm thinking of, I met her several times, and she felt comfortable with me, and she's given me her whole binder of all my task items should anything happen to her.
My husband might want to retain you. He's always like, Diane, I know you're going to pull the plug right away.
Yes, that's something that the family members always have to take into consideration.
Yeah, I've been fighting with my wife. We have this conversation whenever a dog of ours gets sick, mm-hmm. and she wants to end it, and I want to keep him alive at any cost. So I'm afraid that if I get sick, I'm going to get the plug pulled on me, and she's afraid if she gets sick, I'm going to have her linger.
Right.
So
make sure your wishes are in writing. That's my only advice. But I prefer not to make those decisions if I can help it. I think that's a very personal decision, and if there is appropriate family members, I would always, when appropriate, defer to them. But generally speaking, that is one of the responsibilities that we take on.
So when you say you defer to them, but if Neil clearly had in writing that he wanted to be kept alive at all costs.
And if I'm his healthcare director, then my role would be to support his wishes and make sure that every last thing is done to keep Neil alive. God bless you, Neil.
So to change the subject and to judge how pervasive this need is, what is the waiting time if I were to go to court today to get a court date?
I'm not sure. I know they're busy. It's probably there's notice procedural requirements. Yeah. They have to file so far in advance. So it'd be probably a month or two before you could get a court date, depending on the urgency. If there was an immediate exigent circumstances that needed to be addressed, they can pursue what's called a temporary conservatorship, and you can get a court date within 5 days. But generally, it's a month or two. And honestly, the paperwork for that is cumbersome as well. So it often takes the attorney or the person completing it a while to get all the documents in row in line before they go and file them. So,
it's a temporary conservatorship could be a court date within 5 days. In what type of case would that be? That much of an emergency?
If there was an emergency health decision that needed to be made, and there's no clear decision maker to step in and make that decision, if someone needed to be moved, if they were being evicted from their property, something like that.
Understood. So now you had mentioned when you were talking about your services, it almost seems as if you are what a traditional trust company was.
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because you're right. And a lot of banks and corporate entities also fill the role of trustee. And lately, it seemed that the professional fiduciaries are getting a lot more attention because of the time and effort we can put in on a case.
The corporate trustees seem to be getting a little bit more away from that kind of walk the dog,
yeah,
handle
they
the
don't
prescriptions.
Have, they don't have the day-to-day interaction with the clients. They don't have the same knowledge of the clients. They don't have the same availability. There's often high turnover for staff. if there's an emergency on Christmas Eve, you're not ever going to be able to reach the trustee at X, Y, and Z bank. But I can guarantee you that your phone message or call will get through to me. And if something needs to be done, it's much more practical to have somebody on the front lines that's there and understands the client and the situation. We're becoming much more popular because of that. And a lot of banks and trust departments aren't willing to accept some of the smaller cases because they charge on a percentage basis.
Understood. So really the difference is not only the fee structure, but how available they can be to a particular client. Now, do you find that you tend to focus more on a regional area so that you are close by? Like, do you have clients across state lines, or how does that work?
No, we don't go across state lines. Our license doesn't cross state lines without going and getting relicensed there. And, of course, the laws are different in different states. So my specific region is generally Santa Barbara County, north and south here in downtown Santa Barbara. I also go as far as Ventura County. The laws, of course, are all the same within the state. So it's just a matter of being available and being able to give the attention that's needed to that particular case.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back with our last segment. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
And we have in studio with us Courtney DeSoto, who is the owner of Channel Island Fiduciary, and she's been giving us a really informative segment or show on what a fiduciary means and how do people need it. And so, you know, tell us if somebody is out there listening and listening to the various scenarios and it's ringing that they need somebody like you and their family to help with mom or dad as they age, what would be their steps to get in touch with you? Or should they get in touch with you? Should they just write you in their document? How does that work?
They can really do any of the above. I would always encourage, if you're making a big decision like that, as far as naming somebody to meet them. So you can always call me or my office directly. Am I allowed to say my phone number?
Absolutely.
It's 804-3131. We have new office space, so we're right downtown by the courthouse. Very handy. You could also ask an attorney. Attorneys should have a list of the fiduciaries in town. They often will give referrals for us.
Now, is there an initial cost? So let's say I'm interested in using your services and I go and interview with you. Is there a cost for that initial consultation?
At this point, no. I always enjoy meeting people, and if I can help them and point them in the right direction, whether they need a fiduciary or not, I'm always happy to meet with them, and I do so at no charge for the initial meeting.
And I can vouch, Courtney is quite young, so she'll be around for a while.
Young? I didn't think you were allowed to lie on the radio, Diane.
So and that kind of begs another question. What happens if you win the $500 million lottery and you retire?
I did play the Powerball over the weekend, so it did cross my mind a little. I really enjoy what I do. I don't want to diminish what we do or the importance of what we do, but it's almost like being a professional social worker or a professional adult child. We do for our clients what you would do for your elderly parent when they need it at the end of life. And I don't remember.
So you have a succession plan in place in the event something were to happen.
I just brought another fellow fiduciary on board by the name of Justin Redman, who has a great reputation here in town. So there's him and other fiduciaries in town that I would refer to as well. You always want to seek someone that is your child's contemporary, whoever is going to be there administering your affairs when you're no longer there. You want the person that's helping them to be at least contemporary with your children.
That's great advice, because I do feel like, you know, your services cross all socioeconomic lines. So it's not just
really
for the ultra rich or those in poverty. Everybody deals with these family dynamics and needs that objective third party to help sometimes mediate.
Absolutely.
There are mediators in town that sort of take the place of or supplement legal advice. Mm-hmm. Are there mediators that try to avoid all of this?
We work with mediators in some probate matters, absolutely. Anything we can do to make things smoother and more efficient and avoid litigation is always a good thing.
Now, tell us a little bit about your work as a member of the Santa Barbara Elder and Dependent Abuse Prevention Council.
We are a group of professionals here in town that work with the elderly population, and we meet regularly and review upcoming legislation and make comments and recommendations on how to vote for those new bills and laws coming into place, and then we forward those on to our local.
So it's in fact a advocacy group for the population that you're serving, in fact.
Absolutely. We have a whole campaign, Stand Up Against Elder Abuse, and we support World Elder Abuse Prevention Day. We have training conferences in town, and we bring in local speakers. And
well, perfect. Well, thank you for being here with us today, Courtney.
Yeah, thank you, Courtney, so much.
Thank you for having me.
And we will be back next week with another edition of Money Talk.